Hi, I'm Femi Oke. Thanks for joining me on the stream today. We are looking at plastic pollution and what is being done about it. So even if you make a conscious effort not to buy plastic products, you can't escape them because we have plastics inside of us. I will tell you how much in the next half an hour. But first, let's find out how we got to this situation. I'm going to take you all the way back to the 1950s. Since the 1950s, people have thrown away around about 400 million tonnes of plastic waste. And 6.3 billion tonnes of plastic has been generated. And that's according to a study that was done in 2017. Globally, this is, I know, it's extraordinary, isn't it? 400 million tonnes of plastic waste we produce every year. And according to the OECD, plastic waste is on track to almost triple by 2060, with about half of that ending up in landfills. What do we do about that? I know you've got suggestions. I know you've got solutions. Be part of today's show. The comment section is right here and looking forward to your input. Hello, Erica. Hello, Steve. Hello, Satarupa. It's so good to have you. How much plastic is too much plastic for our planet? We are going to get into that and then some. But first of all, Erica, please say hello to our viewers around the world. Tell them who you are and what you do.
Well, first of all, thanks for having me, Femi. My name's Erica Serino. I'm a journalist and author of the book Thicker Than Water, The Quest for Solutions to the Plastic Crisis. I'm based in the United States.
Nice to have you. Hello, Steve. Welcome to the stream. Tell our viewers who you are, what you do.
Hi, Femi, and hello, everybody. My name is Steve Fletcher. I'm the director of the Global Plastics Policy Centre at the University of Portsmouth on the south coast of England. We undertake evidence-based analysis of plastics policies. I'm also a member of the UN International Resource Panel and an editor-in-chief of a new publication called Cambridge Prisms Plastics that shares research that tries to solve the global plastics problem.
All right, great. You can stay. Hello, Satarupa. Nice to have you. Welcome to the stream. Tell our viewers who you are and what you do.
Hello, Femi. Hello, everybody. I'm Satarupa Shekhar. I work with the Break Free from Plastic movement, a global movement that envisions a plastic free future. We basically work to bring systemic change through a holistic approach, tackling plastic pollution across the entire plastics value chain. And we focus on prevention rather than cure and providing effective solutions.
All right. Speed round for all of the guests. Erica, microplastics in a sentence. Explain.
Plastics never benignly biodegrade or break down. They only break up into smaller and smaller pieces of toxic plastic. That's how I would explain microplastic.
Steve, nanoplastics in a sentence. Go.
Even smaller than microplastics, and they can get into places that even microplastics can't get, namely into our bodies, into our bloodstreams, into breast milk, that sort of thing.
Yikes. Okay, so how much plastics do you think we have in our body?
Oh, gosh, that's a super tricky question. Yeah. The research in this area is pretty new, and it's really hard to say, Femi.
Satarupa, bioplastics, in a sentence, tell us.
It basically is plastic that is made partially from materials like potato starch or cornstarch, but eventually functions just like plastic. Right. It has just as many chemicals and is extremely toxic.
Ah, okay. All right. Spoiler alert right there. What is known about plastics? What do we know or what do we not know that we should know? I'm going to go to some of your colleagues, Steve, at the University of Portsmouth, who cooked a lovely Christmas dinner. And one Christmas dinner they made with products that were all wrapped up in plastic, and another Christmas dinner they made with products that were not wrapped up in plastic. Let's see how that experiment went.
So we looked at a plastic wrapped dinner and a non-plastic wrapped dinner, and we cooked them to see how many microplastics were in them. And we found 7 times more microplastics in the wrapped dinner than the non-wrapped dinner. If you were eating an equivalent wrapped dinner every day for a year, you'd be eating about 10 grams of plastic. That's the equivalent of 2 of these a year.
See, I don't know whether I should be alarmed about that. It's just that I'm not thinking about the plastics in my body, but I'm alive, I'm doing the show, I'm walking and talking around. Is this a red flag that we should be doing something about? Steve, you start, and then I'm going to go round to our other guests as well.
Yeah, it's a total red flag, Femi. I mean, the reality is we don't know what harm plastic inside our body is doing, not definitively. I mean, an element of common sense suggests it's not good. And so we might want to take a precautionary approach where we say, well, until we know that this is harmless, we should stop, or at least we should reduce our exposure to plastics in our homes and in our food. That would be the precautionary, sensible thing to do.
Slightly distracted there by a plastic bag being put into an oven. But yes. I want to go to Erica. Erica, you travelled the world looking at what do we know, what should we know about nanoplastics and microplastics and what the dangers are. What would you say was the biggest what the is going on moment that you had?
Well, definitely crossing the Great Pacific Garbage Patch was a big wake-up call. And this was in 2016 when the global consciousness about plastic was really focused more on the problem framed as a marine litter issue or kind of pollution in the ocean, which now we know is far from the only place where plastic pollutes. Plastic pollutes everywhere, including inside of our bodies. But in that reporting and research, I realized that these little particles in the ocean were breaking up into pieces and being consumed by the wildlife living there. On an almost unimaginable scale. And a main problem with this is that these pieces of plastic contain toxic chemicals, and these chemicals are already known to interfere with human hormones, animal hormones. They may cause accumulation of toxins in the body that lead to ill effects over time. So this research is better known in wildlife, but because humans are also animals, we should be very concerned at this point, knowing what we know now about the ill effects, which are very deadly in many cases.
Satya Rupa, there are multiple conversations going on about now what do we do with this? And there is a huge industry, a huge manufacturing industry, fashion industry, plastics industry that we're going to have conversations with. You're in those conversations. How are they going?
So I think first of all, we need to remember that plastics is basically fossil fuel and chemicals. There are more than 10,000 chemicals in plastic. And we actually know the effects that these chemicals have on human and animal life. It's interesting to see that it's those industries that are continuing to promote the production, even the extraction of fossil fuels, production of the polymers that go into making plastics, and then continue to promote, what we call false solutions in how we manage plastic waste. These can range from incinerators and waste to energy plants to just cement kilns. And what we're finding across the world, in Asia, we've been running studies, even chickens that, just are feeding off worms or in the very near vicinity of a cement kiln tend to have dioxins of in human beings. That are living very close to these cement kilns, right? So this is a very, very direct, transfer of the chemicals from plastics right into our bodies. And there is actually a lot we can do. We really need to have very significant, progressive, and mandatory caps on production of fossil fuel-based plastics. We need to control, these false solutions or unicorns. We keep chasing our tails with how plastic can be managed. It really cannot be managed. I think what Erica also talked about was just the it's so pervasive. It's in our bodies. We cannot avoid the kinds of clothes we wear, the water we drink. It's in salt. It's in honey. It's in beer. Mm-hmm. It's in everything we're ingesting consciously. But also it's in toothpaste. It's in face wash. So companies are very consciously making the choice to add plastics, microbeads into products, everyday products that we really just can't avoid.
See, that seems like a very... Steve, go ahead. I had a thought, but I'm sure your thought is much smarter than mine, so you go first. Go ahead.
I hope so now. I'm just going to add really to what Satyarupa was saying, really. Yeah. Historically, the solutions to plastic pollution have been seen as what are called downstream. So once the plastic has already been created and it's escaped into the world, then we think solutions like recycling or collecting plastic and putting it into landfill is plastic management. But that doesn't really prevent the pollution and the sorts of dire consequences that Satyarupa was just explaining, and I'm sure we've all got stories like that to add to that, to those that sort of list of terrible problems. But what we really need to be doing is putting in place upstream solutions. It's solutions that can prevent the plastic pollution in the first place, not that try and solve the pollution once it's become pollution. It's too late by then.
So are we talking, Steve? So this is where my thought and your thought comes together. Yeah. Are we talking about then there's certain products that have got little beads in, like little bits of plastic in, and they exfoliate your skin or they help clean better, that we just say, let's just not put them and create them in the first place? That would be simple, wouldn't it?
Yeah, you'd think so. A global agreement to remove those sorts of plastics from products would be wonderful. I mean, we don't need those plastics to be in those products, really. There will be natural alternatives or just other ways of achieving the same outcome. So we have to really find ways to prevent plastic entering the economy or entering the food chain or entering us in whatever way we can, and stopping them getting into the products in the first place would be the obvious first step.
So there's a global plastics treaty, which feels like this would be a good place for the world to come together and say, this is how we want our world to be. We do not need this much plastic. Erica, just before I play a little clip from a gathering that happened in Uruguay, which was just a few weeks ago at the end of the year, what does the public need to know about this global plastics treaty? What is important about it?
What's important about this treaty is that we need to make sure it's strong, enforceable, and covers the full toxic existence of plastic from the moment its fossil fuel ingredients are pulled from the ground to its end use, and after its end use, when it's either disposed by incineration, illegal dumping into a landfill or the environment or some other means. And as Satyarupta and Steve mentioned, there are a lot of false solutions now on the table. And one key false solution I want to identify is so-called advanced or chemical recycling, which is just a process whereby plastics are kind of melted down in a way into more simple petrochemical and fossil fuel components, and typically not even turned into plastic again, so not recycled, but burned as a petrochemical or a fossil fuel type product. And so we need to keep those false solutions out of the Global Plastics Treaty and have a hard-hitting agreement that kind of will show us all the way we need to move forward, and at the core have values that lead to a more regenerative, sustainable, and just world.
All right, so this is a very tough negotiation because it's real policy and asking for certain plastics and certain production methods to be just be banned, just ban them. So this is Inga Andersen. She's the executive director of the United Nations Environment Programme, and she was at this Global Plastics Treaty, this gathering. She's sitting next to the Minister of Environment for Uruguay, and this is what she told a press conference. Let's have a listen.
And it is ambitious to end plastic pollution, but it is entirely doable. It is in our hands. And I am very optimistic that we can work on the base of science, on the base of strong national leadership, to deliver an agreement text by the end of 2 years. It's complicated. We have chemicals, we have industry, we have interests, we have waste pickers, but everyone wants plastic out of the environment.
Satyarupa, I was in Uruguay and I was watching the conversations between the multi-stakeholders, excuse me for doing UN speak just for a moment, which means everybody can have a say in what is going on. And there were people there from the industry, the plastics industry, and some of the other stakeholders were very upset that they were in the room having the conversation. Do they not provide a route to finding a solution if they come with a genuine sense of how can we do better? Or do we not need to have a plastics industry? Are we asking for them to wrap themselves up?
You know, so Femi, I was in Uruguay as well.
All right, Satyarupa, I'm so sorry. We're going to call you back because we've got a little bit of a problem with your connection. So we're going to call you back and I'll just hold that response for a moment. But let me just go to Erica on this, because I know you've been reporting on this as well, about what do you do with the big plastics industry? Are they genuinely wanting to say, how do we improve this situation? Or is it a little bit like Tobacco, the sequel?
Well, unfortunately, we are seeing a kind of repeat of Tobacco, the sequel. And in fact, people involved in the tobacco negotiations warned people involved now in the plastics negotiations that the industry is trying the same tactics. And we do see the same repetitiveness in the narrative as well. So, you know, putting that together, it's painting a very clear picture that the fox is in the hen house.
I know our audience will be thinking, Steve, what about recycling? What about bioplastics? I love Satyarupa. It's like, bioplastics, they don't work. They just create a problem. She was like, no, that's not going to work. But what will work? What are you working on? What are you researching? There can be practical solutions.
Yeah, it's a great question, Femi. What we're researching at the moment is really trying to understand where in the plastics life cycle would radical and progressive policy really make a difference to reducing plastic pollution, really achieve substantial reductions in plastic pollution. And what we're finding is a little bit like I said before, it's really focusing on upstream solutions. So essentially two things. One is to reduce plastic entering the economy in the first place. So that's substituting plastic out. It's reducing our reliance on plastic. It's encouraging reuse schemes that prevent reduce the amount of plastic that we need in the first place. So that's the first thing, reducing plastic entering the economy. Mm-hmm. And the second thing is then once plastic is in the economy, then we make sure that plastic is the sort of plastic we really need and that plastic can be reused and circulated in the economy for as long as possible. So we begin to decouple our economic and social activity from a reliance upon virgin plastics, because it's the virgin plastics that create, you know, tremendous fossil fuels and the ultimate, they create tremendous carbon emissions and that ultimately tend to become the plastic pollution of the future.
I'm going to go to YouTube and bring Satyarupa back in. We've got a stable connection now. Carl Marston says, I guess my main point is, how do governments even confront these large multinational companies like Nestle, PepsiCo, Coca-Cola? Are they companies, Satyarupa, that you are going to have to, as an activist, as somebody who's talking to these big plastic polluters? How are those conversations going?
So the break becomes plastic.
Yeah.
Well, mixed. It's usually one step forward and many steps back. Mm. The Break Free from Plastic movement has been conducting brand audits for 5 years, and we know who the polluters are. We know what some of their tactics are to distract and derail progress on policy. We have evidence where they are actually very, systematically undermining very progressive policies. Just one case that I'd like to refer to. India had a clause in the solid waste management rules of 2016, which said that multi-layered plastics would be banned or eliminated by 2018. Mm. We actually know companies, Unilever, Nestle, and the others, who have lobbied for that clause to be removed, right? So we're actually moving backward, despite knowing that sachets and multi-layered packaging is basically there's nothing that one can do about it. At the same time, what we're having is Unilever had launched something called Creosolve. Erica mentioned advanced recycling or chemical recycling. They launched it with a lot of fanfare, and then it closed within 2 years after millions of dollars had been spent.
What?
Right. So we're seeing
How is that possible? How many millions?
Several millions. I'm sorry, I just don't have it at hand, but they launched it in Indonesia. They tried to convince a lot of governments that is feasible. Oof. It is not. Okay. The other thing that, you know, Steve was talking about was reuse projects. They launch projects, but they're only pilots. They never scale. They don't allow them to scale up.
All right, so a quick answer here. And Erica, let's do this one with you. From YouTube, what about a plastics tax?
A plastics tax? Mm-hmm. Well, that's difficult, but we can implement producer responsibility schemes that require corporations to take back the plastics that they produce, or at least be held financially or logistically responsible. Uh-huh. But I don't think it would be ever fair to tax people because they're not creating the pollution, it's the industries.
Femi, in our research, we found that a plastic tax by itself doesn't necessarily create the change we want to see, but a plastic tax can reinforce other policies. So, for example, if we wanted to substitute out plastic for a less polluting material, then we could put a tax on virgin plastics that would make the substitute more economically attractive to certain industries. So a tax by itself doesn't really do the job, but a tax with a collection or a suite of other policies can actually be really quite effective.
You spoke earlier to Dr. Michelle Barry. I'm just going to bring her voice in because I think she sums up where we are with our conversation right now today. Here she is.
Well, we can't only recycle our way out of the global plastic problem. We need economic practices that reimagine supply chains to decrease single-use plastics. And we need to financially incentivize plastic collection and recycling. We need technological innovation to do a better cleanup of microplastic pollution so that we're not consuming the equivalent of a plastic credit card in 1 week's time.
Satya Rupa, a really quick response from our audience who are watching right now. You cannot build a cell phone with glass. You have to have plastic. Instant response to that viewer.
We can think about how long that is used. Do we really need to use it so frequently, replace things so frequently? I think what Steve was also saying, I think, was also once it's in the system, how do we make sure that it stays in the system as long as possible, right? If we really need some kinds of plastic, then let's prioritize those. If it's for medical reasons, for example, why do we need, you know, single-use disposable cutlery, which we can really do without? And there are great alternatives too.
Steve, you're going to say something?
Yeah, I was thinking. Yeah, I mean, it's hard to justify, I think, Femi, bringing in plastics into the economy that we know can't be reused, that can't be recycled, that can't be effectively collected, that are toxic, and that, you know, harm people's health. I mean, how is that an acceptable position for the world to adopt? And so we have to really think really carefully about what is a necessary plastic, and there may be some necessary plastic.
And do we have to upgrade plastic that we use, right? So if you've got a phone that's a number whatever, why do you have to buy the next level? This is my bugbear here. Why do you have to buy the next level of phone? Only because the manufacturer tells you you have to, not because you necessarily need to. All right, my voice will not be the last voice, the last comment on this show. I've got one more person to bring in. And this is Andres, who's looking ahead to what is going to happen in the world of plastic pollution this year. This is what he told us.
What we are seeing now on plastics is not a demand issue. It's an issue of oversupply driving use. Annual plastic production will continue to rise and currently equals 400 million tons. That is the weight of 40,000 Eiffel Towers per year. On the legal front, expect to see more actions against polluters on the grounds of environmental justice and human rights, like the case filed this week against the food company Danone in France for their continuous failing to reduce their plastic footprint. By the end of the year, I'm cautiously optimistic that we will see a draft of the international treaty setting out measures to cap and phase down production, consumption, and use of plastics.
And this is the current story that Andres was talking about. Activists sue French food firm Danone over the use of plastics. Maybe this is the future. Maybe the legal stick is what we need to have fewer amounts of plastic in our environment. Thank you to Erica, to Steve, to Satya Rupa, and to you for being part of today's program. Appreciate you. See you next time.